Hello and welcome to Crosscut Talks, a podcast replay of Crosscut's live interviews with the people who shape our world. I'm Mark Baumgarten, the news and politics editor at Crosscut. The scientists charting the impacts of climate change continue to issue dire predictions about our planet's future. In late 2018, the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change released a report stating that some of the most devastating effects could be felt as soon as 2040. The National Climate Assessment, a federal report on climate impacts within the United States, also had some grim predictions, including more flooding in the east and more wildfires in the west. Crosscut gathered the co-authors of those two reports, along with other climate policy experts, to help us understand what it all means and where we can look for hope. Christy Ebi is a professor of public health at the University of Washington and director of the Center for Health and the Global Environment. She has been researching the health risks of climate change for over 20 years and was a lead author on the two latest IPCC reports. Heidi Roop is lead scientist for science communication with the University of Washington's Climate Impacts Group. She is also an affiliate assistant professor in the university's Department of Environmental and Occupational Health Sciences. She was a co-author on the latest National Climate Assessment. Michael Cox worked for the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency for nearly three decades. His latest role was as climate change advisor for the agency's Seattle office. He retired in 2017 and made his letter of resignation public to voice his criticism of the Trump administration's approach to the climate crisis. Rashad Morris is program officer at the Bullitt Foundation, where he manages the Energy, Climate, and Materials and Deep Green Buildings programs. He previously served as a policy analyst for the Washington State Senate and the Washington Environmental Council. Crosscut science and environment editor Ted Alvarez moderated the discussion. This conversation is sponsored by Comcast and the Nature Conservancy. It was recorded on May 4th, 2019 at Seattle University as part of the Crosscut Festival.
October of last year, the International Panel on Climate Change released a report that functionally landed like a bombshell. In broad strokes, it concluded we have 12-ish years or so to make unheard of changes to our global energy infrastructure to keep average temperatures at or below 1.5 degrees Celsius. If we failed, what followed would be catastrophic crop failures, extreme weather events, perhaps threats to to civilization as we know it. Essentially, the apocalypse was nigh-ish. But one unexpected effect from that report is that climate change is finally capturing national attention in ways that it hasn't before. And therein lies the opportunity for increased awareness, engagement, and action. Can we, in fact, cancel the apocalypse? To help light the way, we're lucky enough to be joined by four people who are in the front lines of climate research and action. And I'm going to ask them to introduce themselves briefly before we get started.
Christy Ebi, I was an author on this report that you mentioned. I'm at the University of Washington. I've been working on climate change issues for more than 20 years.
Hi, I'm Heidi Roop. I'm a research scientist at the University of Washington Climate Impacts Group, and we work regionally to build resilience to the changes in climate that we know we've set in motion.
I'm Mike Cox. I am retired, but before that I worked for almost 35 years internationally in Africa for 5 years with the Environmental Protection Agency for over 25 and the City of Seattle for 3 years.
And my name is Rashad Morris. I'm a program officer at the Bullitt Foundation. The Bullitt Foundation is a regional philanthropic foundation that supports nonprofit organizations who work on environmental issues. In particular, I support a portfolio of grantees working in the energy and climate space.
I'd like to start by setting the tone. Something that that Chris said that stuck with me is that you, in the middle of all of this, with everybody reacting and you know, hyperventilating about 12 years, if you search actually on Google, type in IPCC, and the next words you get are 12 years and apocalypse. But you have characterized yourself as a worried optimist. So to set that tone and bring us out of this terror spiral, why do you call yourself a worried optimist? And then I'd like to hear from all of you your basically the reasons why you're optimistic.
I will start with a very brief summary of what actually was concluded in this report. The first conclusion was the Earth has already warmed 1 degree C, or about 2 degrees Fahrenheit. And there are consequences for our health right here, consequences for our health worldwide, consequences for our ecosystems, and consequences for our livelihoods. In other words, climate change is already affecting our lives in many different dimensions. The second key conclusion was that if we continue on current emissions, the Earth will warm another half degree, another 1 degree Fahrenheit, by sometime between 2030 and 2052. There's lots of uncertainty about how the climate system will respond to the additional greenhouse gases. So there is this broad range. So first of all, the 12 years is not what the IPCC concluded. We said between 2030 and 2052. And the consequences of that would be even more significant for our health, for our ecosystems, for our livelihoods. And we documented that in a lot of detail. Happy to answer questions on that. The third main conclusion was there are literally thousands of options, adaptation options to prepare, to manage the kinds of changes we're already seeing, and mitigation to reduce the consequences later in the century by reducing our greenhouse gas emissions. And when you look across these thousands of options, one key conclusion is every action matters. There's things that we can do at all levels, from our individual, up through the community, through the nation, through the world. So there's lots of options out there. And it really comes down to political will, how willing we are to take some fairly simple changes in our lives that will improve our health and improve our own pocketbook. And so if we do take these actions, we are already seeing those actions underway. These are not new, they're already underway, that we can really reduce the amount of warming that we'll see within the next couple of decades. And that's why I'm concerned, but I'm also optimistic because we do see enormous shifts underway around the world in terms of our energy infrastructure, in terms of the actions individuals are taking to prepare for and mitigate a changing climate.
Just kind of jump off of that and ask Heidi and everybody chime in. What are some of the adaptations you're seeing or you're excited about for the Northwest in particular?
That's a great question, and I will sort of leapfrog on the optimism. I think the privilege that I have in my role at the Climate Impacts Group is that I get to be embedded in conversations with decision makers, with community members, with tribal entities who are all grappling with these changes that we are experiencing here and now. We're seeing the impacts of climate change emerge. We feel them. Many of us were breathing smoky air if you were here last summer, last couple of summers. Those are just examples of how we're feeling climate change and what we anticipate to be more normal in the future. And I get to be part of conversations where people are thinking about investments that are being made, quite frankly, on our behalf with our taxpayer dollars that are shaping our communities, the futures of our communities, once in a generation investments in infrastructure. And people are really concerned about whether they have the right climate science information to be making smart decisions so that when we're building a bridge or a culvert that accommodates salmon, it also is built large enough to cope with the future floods that we expect to see here in the Northwest. It's looking at our water treatment facilities, people actively making smart investments now so that they know they can provide reliable drinking water to their customers. So those are all places where I see hope. And I think the challenge in that is that I know I get to be part of those conversations or hear those stories, and I feel a deep responsibility to start sharing those stories in more meaningful ways, because I think those are the places that are inspiring. Seeing people just like yourselves making these decisions, being champions for change, often embedded in significant bureaucracies or where there are institutional barriers that traditionally have prevented action, people are overcoming those, and they're overcoming them on our behalf.
Do you have, I'm curious just to pull that out a bit, do you have a go-to story that you like to share, something that's kind of emblematic of those of that hope you see on the community level?
Yeah, there's several, and I'll just bring one to mind because I had the opportunity to work with about 40 educators this week up in Anacortes, and we were lucky enough to have one of their engineers come talk to us about up in Anacortes, about the Anacortes water treatment plant, where one individual essentially realized that there was information available that could help them redesign their system to be more climate resilient. And in that process, they've made their design, they've elevated their design, they can process more sediment. We're seeing more sediment in our rivers as our glaciers melt. They basically decided the investment before seeing all these impacts emerge was well worth it. And now that they've deployed this water treatment plant in Anacortes, it's actually a national example of excellent climate adaptation. You'll see the EPA, it's on their website. It's a shining star in our near neighborhood of progressive thinking and proactive thinking that's already paying dividends financially.
It's good to hear that something's on EPA's websites about climate change.
I just checked like last week.
It's still there? Yeah. Wow, okay. I'll start out on the federal level, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. But that part is very discouraging. And I've worked on a lot of the things in the Obama administration trying to get in place kind of the cornerstones of a climate program that I think was making real progress. But I don't want to dwell on the federal program. I think all you have to do is look at the legislature this term. They did some incredible things. First in the country for many things. No more coal in 2025. 100% clean energy by 2045. Some amazing stuff. So it's happening on the state. It's happening on the local level. I'll just use an example of where I live on Bainbridge Island. We formed a climate change advisory committee. I'm the chair of that. We are going in and we are going to incorporate climate change into the shoreline management plan, into critical ordinance issues. We're going to look at green building ordinances. We are going to the schools to educate those folks. We're having once a month community discussions. So on the local and state level, I think action is really happening. And another hopeful part for me, if you look at the middle of the country, take Kansas, take Iowa, take these states and you go, those are red as red can get. Kansas, I think now they're up to almost 40% of their electrical generation is what? It's wind. North Dakota, that whole line there, it's incredible. 20, 30, 40%, and they want more. So this issue that people always say it's a red and blue, I don't think it has to be. I think there's an economic argument to be made for transitioning to clean energy and clean transportation, and I think we're starting to see that evolve. And the last part that gives me hope is kids. I have two kids, they're 20, 23. And when I talk to them and their friends, they get it. They get it. They know that it's, you know, we messed it up and we're gonna try to do what we can before I part the earth, but they get it. They're gonna make the changes. And that gives me hope that we're gonna turn the corner and we are gonna make this better.
Yeah, likewise. I'm an optimist by nature, but also a pragmatist. I've spent the last decade plus of my life working in public policy and politics, and when you're in the thick of it, things seem to move slowly sometimes, but one of the things that we always have to remind ourselves is that any movement in history, especially if you look in the United States, has happened in fits and starts, and it hasn't been a linear progression of people understanding that there's a problem and then immediately working to address it. It's often a much more attenuated process. You look back to the abolitionist movement. You look at women's suffrage. You look at civil rights. Many of these issues we're still fighting today, 100, 150 years later. We've made progress, but that progress tends to start off slow and then ramps up very quickly. And part of the work that I think all of us are doing in one way or another is to be catalysts for that, no matter where things are along that line of progression. And so one of the things that makes me most hopeful about the future for addressing climate change is the ways in which different stakeholders and constituency groups are taking on this issue as personal and relevant to themselves. Mike just mentioned the legislative success of in Washington State in 2019, part of that legislative success was actually built on a failure. Two failures, if we're going to be frank about it, which are the two ballot initiatives, the one in 2016 and the one in 2018 last year, that were designed to address climate change, but both failing at the ballot. Even though both ballot initiatives failed, over 1.5 million Washingtons voted in support of them. Another little thing that we need to keep in mind, sometimes these failures are not, they don't lead to the results that we would like, but they increase the momentum. And in this past legislative session, you saw social justice groups, communities of color, the labor movement, health professionals, a wide variety of folks who either heretofore had been peripherally engaged in a real political way on climate change, really show up. And not only did they show up, but they made sure that the policies that passed, Mike mentioned the 100% clean policy that passed just a couple of weeks ago, not only does it address greenhouse gas emissions, reducing fossil fuels in our energy mix, but it also addresses the impact on workers at those companies who will be who have to change their operations in order to comply. It deals with the impacts on ratepayers who potentially could face an increase in their electricity rates by going to more renewable clean energy by mitigating that. And so by designing these solutions in ways that engage a broader swath of the electorate or the populace, I think we'll see more and more momentum.
Pull out a little bit more of what you said there. It occurs to me that especially at the state and local level, there's a lot of opportunity for intersectionality of solutions where you kind of mentioned it briefly. We're addressing social justice problems, all kinds of other issues at the same time that we're tackling climate problems. So I was hoping you could maybe, anyone really, just pull out some other examples of places where that intersectionality is tackling a bunch of things at the same time.
Well, I'll just really briefly mention one of the policies that passed was the Clean Buildings Act. In the Clean Buildings Act, not only does it require that all of the so let me back up a little bit. When people think about industry emission sectors, they tend to chunk them into transportation, electric generation, and the built environment. We've got to address all of them. Some of them are easier to address than others. One of the more challenging areas to address is the built environment. The energy that goes in to heat and cool our buildings, the materials that go in to build and construct the buildings, all of those have emissions, carbon emissions profiles that go along with them. And this particular policy was designed in a way to require all buildings built in Washington State to meet a certain greenhouse gas emission standard. But not only that, it required, it provided incentives for building developers and building owners to use prevailing wages for the labor that's doing that, to hire locally for the people who are installing the insulation or who are building the buildings. And so by connecting these two issues of economic development and labor with environmental sustainability, you can create better and stronger momentum. And that's just one example of the ways in which people are thinking about the ways that these issues impact each other and can mutually reinforce each other.
And just to highlight, I think the Green New Deal, everybody has their own opinions of that, but what I thought it did, it nationally catalyzed this discussion, just like you're saying, that just not about energy, it's all interconnected. And you have to look at it in a much more holistic way that you do. I think you do get the constituencies to rally around that. And the Green New Deal has always been blasted by certain people. And the nice thing about retirement, you can kind of say whatever you want anymore. So it doesn't matter. So for that reason alone, I think the Green New Deal has really helped in the conversation for people to get out of this box of, oh, we just need 100% clean energy. Well, there's a whole bunch of reasons why we need that, and there's a whole bunch of other things that are tied into that that we need to also be really, really cognizant of if we want to make progress and if we want to succeed down this path that I think we're headed.
I'll make two follow-up comments on that. One is you need to understand the synergies and the trade-offs. And there's significant synergies and trade-offs with almost all options. So two examples, if you look in this report, the IPCC report in Chapter 5, there was an absolutely massive effort to look at synergies and trade-off for energy production, energy demand, and land use. And one example of the trade-offs is if we aim to significantly lower our emissions, when you look at the models on how we can do that, all of those models have a very large amount of bioenergy built into them, because that's a key way to get our emissions down. And then you look at how much land would be required to produce whatever they're using to turn into the bioenergy. And there's a real trade-off with agricultural land. And so using a lot of bioenergy is likely to increase food insecurity for the poor, because we'll take away so much agricultural land, the price of food goes up. We can afford that, the poor cannot. And so you do need to look at these intersections to understand these synergies and trade-offs, because we don't want to make choices that in the end will be harmful to some sectors and will increase inequities. So there is a lot that needs to be done in looking across these synergies and trade-offs. And then another example I'll give, building on the ones we just heard, is that livestock are a significant portion of greenhouse gas emissions. There's a lot of energy required to grow the crops that the cows, sheep, goats then eat. And then there's all the energy to turn them into whatever is sold in our supermarket, the transport costs. So they're a really major source of emissions. And so if everyone in the U.S. ate how much meat their doctors recommended, which we're not achieving, but if we just ate how much meat our doctors recommended, we'd have an enormous reduction in our emissions. And by the way, eating too much meat raises blood pressure, it raises cholesterol, puts you at greater risk for heart attack, increases weight. There's all kinds of downside risks of eating too much meat. And so we can reduce our consumption of meat in a thoughtful way that helps our health and then helps the planet as well.
That's great. I think that kind of illustrates maybe a little bit why we're in the moment that we're in, which is storytelling and the impact that that has on getting people to understand both the severity of the crisis, but also their place in it. And so I'm curious if what experiences you have personally working in science, being on the front lines of this, that are just really visceral. I'm thinking of, like, Heidi, your work on with ice cores in Antarctica, how you use those experiences to kind of relate the story of climate change to people.
That's a challenging question because there are a lot of layers there to unpack.
Pick your favorite. It's fine.
Yeah, one being that far off distant places that I've been lucky enough to travel to understand how our Earth's climate has changed over hundreds of thousands of years, with some of the brightest scientific minds asking really deep questions about how today is different from the past and really contextualizing what we're observing now. It's exotic, it's exciting. Going to Antarctica is amazing, and not many people have the opportunity to do that. So that's a great way to bring people along. We fly in planes, ironically. People get excited by that. We have all sorts of weird equipment. We drive around the continent to support the science that we do. And that's an interesting way to bring people into a conversation, but more importantly, it's about a personal connection. I've been lucky enough to go there, and I, through the state and the legislation and in this new budget, actually continued funding to support building capacity for every state educator in Washington State to teach climate science in the classroom. This is K through 12, and so for the last year, I've been traveling around with a nonprofit organization called Washington Green Schools, actually talking with teachers about Antarctica and the context, how we know the climate's changing. But the really powerful piece, and I think this is no matter who you're talking to, is we focus everything around what matters in that region and in your backyard. So even when we take apart Washington State, there are climate impacts that matter to communities differently depending on where you are. So we have tailored all of our content to really explore what information we have that's regionally relevant. And that's when people start to care, when it's your backyard, when it's your school or your classroom or your community. And so a lot of the work that I do is thinking about what are those stories, and importantly, who is telling those stories and who's at the heart of those stories. And we open all of these workshops, and I encourage you to do this with your family and friends, because if there's one thing we know about climate change communication is that there's an absence of it. 64% of Americans never talk about climate change. Those numbers are probably shifting, hopefully. And 40% of adult Americans don't believe that climate change will harm them personally. And those are two things that I'd love to see change. And people, when you connect them to those dots, like wildfires and smoke and your health, people who are experiencing that and connecting it to climate change creates some of the most profound moments I've had with individuals. They didn't really make the connection. And then all of a sudden, it's, you know, you sort of take this step back. But I think there are a lot of pieces there. It's about what we know about our gorgeous and complex planet that's inspiring to people. I think I look to space and think, man, NASA does a great job. So many of us are inspired by space. But our planet is also inspiring and complex and beautiful. And it's about thinking on scales that are hard to comprehend and then bringing it to the scales that really matter. And that's your own backyard and your own family.
I'd love to add on to what Heidi was just sharing. When the impacts and the solutions are relevant to people's lives is when you start to see change. We can talk about Antarctica, but we can go a lot closer to home. You can look, Mike just mentioned Iowa, Nebraska, and Kansas. A couple of months ago, we had the bomb cyclone that went over the middle of the country. This giant snowstorm, which, you know, the climate models are predicting we will see more types of weather events like that. It has prevented farmers from planting in their fields. These are people who depend, they plan their whole year, their life of income on these short planting cycles, and so many of those farms remain underwater months later. And so when they see that, okay, this is going to be happening more and more frequently, this is going to be a direct impact on my life, then you can have conversations. And one of the things that I get super excited about is trying to support folks who have historically not been participating in the conversation to think about these issues. It's one of the things that we do in the foundation is support organizations who normally would not think of themselves as environmental organizations, but who are facing the impacts. And so I believe there's a great opportunity to talk to those farmers in the heartland about, you know, what they're dealing with right now. Not next year, not 20 years from now, but literally right now they can't plant. And because they can't plant, they don't know what their income is going to look like at the end of the year. That's an opportunity to go back to what Christy was saying, to build that political will, to build that knowledge and that sense of urgency and relevancy to a broader constituency so that we can really start to address these things.
And what you said was interesting. I call it the threat that I'm stealing this from somebody, actually, so I have to. It's a threat too big to talk about, climate change. We just go, how do we talk about this? And I always thought that was good. But just a personal story, when I first started in a job in climate change at EPA, I hit the road. I went up to Alaska, Alaska Forum on Environment, organized a session of elders, Alaska Native village elders. It was incredible. They just related their stories. And these, they just, story after story after story of how the land was changing and how it was changing their lives. Then I went to Eastern, I went to Idaho, I went to Eastern Washington, I grew up in Walla Walla. I went back to farmers who I grew up with and talked to them and just said, what do you think? And as we talked before, sometimes you don't use climate change, but you go to their place. And incredible how they appreciate that. I'm going to Taylor Shellfish. The most effective person I've ever seen on ocean acidification was Bill Dewey. He is a spokesperson or something for Taylor Shellfish, and people listen to him because it is his life. It's a whole bunch of people's lives. And going to the tribes here, going to the people fishing, and the water is getting too hot for the salmon. So I guess my point is I went out and learned those stories, and then I decided, okay, how am I going to do this? And so one idea that I have, and I haven't started too much, is a Rotarian. If you're a Rotarian, you can go to other Rotarians and talk to them. And so I just encourage people that wherever you are, the people that you're around, they'll listen to you. They may not listen to some pointy head bureaucrat, but they'll listen to you. if an Aquinas or a JC's or Rotor or whatever organization. So I really encourage you to go out and do that, because that's how change is. It's the person to person. That's how I really feel that a lot of change is happening. And it's on all of us to do that. It's just not us four here. It's on all of us.
And come back to every action matters, and there's lots that all of us can do, that every other year King County gives a Green Globe Award. And those were awarded 2 weeks ago to a dozen organizations around King County that are undertaking amazing action. And you can go and look up who won those awards. People are working on salmon. People are working on cleaning up the Duwamish. Long list. So you can think about what excites you and where you'd like to put your energies. And individual energy and enthusiasm really matters. And it can make a really big difference. We also need to vote, because we need to continue to have the political leadership we need in the state of Washington. But work on all scales.
And don't give up.
Definitely not. Speaking of giving up or not giving up, but moving on, for people who don't know, Mike Cox retired with a letter, a scathing letter calling out the EPA head at the time, Scott Pruitt, for derelicting the basic duties of the EPA. There are a bunch of people still working there. I'm curious, just from the insider's view, what morale is like now, two years later, and there's a lot more political momentum. But yeah, I'm curious if you have any insight into that.
You're retired, so.
Yeah, I'm retired.
You choose not to.
Let her rip. It hasn't improved, and it hasn't improved for a number of reasons. Every year, there's a budget that comes out from the president, and this year it's, like it always is, 30 to 40% cut in EPA. 30, 40%, that's a lot. Whole programs eliminated. Climate change research, eliminated. Puget Sound program, eliminated. Lead in drinking water, eliminated. And of course, Congress doesn't allow that to happen because it's all, their constituency. But when you're working for somebody who says you're not valued, what do you do after a while? You get discouraged. And so I have a number of friends my age who can retire. They're retiring. They're saying, I've had enough. Enough is enough. I'm going to do something else. And these are people who did this for 30, 35 years through a Republican administration. And I was talking beforehand that I worked for six administrations, clear back to Reagan. I never thought that the head of the EPA, the administrator, was anti-EPA. They're Republicans, Christy Todd Whitman, Bill Riley, Bill Ruckelshaus. While we didn't always agree, never thought that these people were trying to countermand the mission of EPA. With Scott Pruitt and now Andrew Wheeler, who's a lot slicker, that's not the case. Also, what was really discouraging is before I left, I had a number of young scientists who came up and said, Mike, I don't know why I'm here. I'm not allowed to do science. What am I going to do here? And I encouraged them to stay on, wait it out. We really needed you. And I talked to some of them now, and some of them had left because they said, I can't do this anymore. I can't be in an organization that doesn't value science. And not that the majority of people in EPA don't, it's just that the leadership doesn't. And finally, when the head of the EPA Andrew Wheeler said, climate change is not one of my priorities. And if your boss says that and you think climate change is, like Janet Napolitano said, climate change is one of the biggest threats, not globally. And I think many of us agree with that. So to answer your question, morale isn't good, and they're not replacing people. So I'm just hoping, I think Chris was right, elections have consequences. And we really found that out in 2016. They really do. And for EPA especially, they did.
Silver lining, under a different administration, there could be an entire cohort of young climate leaders to take over those positions that have recently been vacated in the EPA. Eternal optimist here.
And they're out there. And they're out there.
Yeah, you mentioned backstage that your son, I believe, is going into climate science, potentially.
Doing a PhD program at University of Washington in atmospheric science, climate change, and his interest in the Arctic issues. So I don't know if I did anything right, but, you know, maybe.
So all of you are in mentorship positions. How do you keep people motivated, you know, who are going to be the successors, you know, in these positions? I imagine you'd have to say, stick it out, or how do you get them to do that? Or do you see that enthusiasm natively in the people that you work with?
As a professor at the University of Washington, students really are impassioned about this issue. And so we see class sizes growing every year. Students really want to work on this issue. So very important for them. They understand the importance of addressing the challenges of our changing climate and want to contribute. And so the university is working hard on that education. We do need education in the K through 12. It needs to spread more broadly, but we do see the enthusiasm. The challenge is, as Mike just articulated, as students start coming up to graduation, of where do you find positions? I work right now in climate change and health, and there's essentially no federal funding. And you try, and there's no funding at the international level as well. And so it's a real challenge, because I keep graduating students who want to work in climate change and health, and at this moment, there's nowhere for them to go. And so they're taking positions they would prefer not to take, because they've got to pay bills as much as the rest of us, and just hoping that there'll be a shift soon enough so this actually becomes a career choice, and we can channel this enthusiasm into the innovation and change we're going to need to address the challenges coming at us.
I would say that I think the students that I have the great opportunity to work with motivate me. I don't know if I motivate them, but they certainly motivate me with innovative thinking, wanting to work across sectors and disciplines and work in real, applied, creative solutions and contexts. And I think that has been motivating for me to see this transition of what they're defining is their education or the education they want, and being bold enough to bring in new people and new ideas and community members and mentors and people that they see doing the work they want to do. And so I'm really inspired by sort of the dismissal of, oh, well, my professor people, you know, or they're really looking to examples for where they can meaningfully contribute and gain skills and expertise for doing applied solutions-based work. And that is incredibly motivating to me. And bringing what they're learning at the university and from professors, I don't mean to diminish us academics, but really challenging the model for what it means to learn and from whom and what is knowledge. And how do we move forward? And what does a career look like? And how do I create change? And that motivates me. So I should ask the students I get to work with if I motivate them at all. It's a good question.
You motivate me, Heidi, okay?
Oh, thanks.
How's that?
You want to come work on a capstone with me?
Capstone?
Yeah, 100 hours?
You know, I'd say that one of the things that has been really inspiring for me is to see the aha moment for folks who historically had not thought of this as their issue. And I'll give you an anecdotal example. A few years ago, the Bullitt Foundation approached an organization called Community to Community up in Bellingham. And this organization is a farm workers' rights organization. And their long history of work had been focused on alleviating the burdens on migrant farm workers. And these are folks who are here legally under our visa system to harvest crops for a certain number of time. Many of them are not citizens, don't vote, can't vote. We bring them in under a legal process, have them harvest the crops, and then they move on to a different part of the country or they move back to their home countries. And when we first started having conversations with them, they said, well, why would I be interested or engaged in a climate policy campaign? There are farm workers out there who are not getting paid wages, who are living in substandard housing, who are not getting adequate breaks or food or water. What does this climate thing have to do with me? Our response was, here's some funding for you to participate with some other organizations who are working on this issue, and some time for you to figure out how this issue does impact you and your constituency, because frankly, this is an existential, climate change is an existential issue that impacts all of us. A year later, what we found was this organization and the people that it represented became some of the most eloquent spokespeople in support of climate action. And part of this came out of a bit of a tragedy. One of the migrant farm workers picking berries in Bellingham died in the fields. And there was a question about how this person died. Well, it turned out that it was a combination of working in high levels of heat in the summer, when there was lots of smoke from the wildfires. This person was not given breaks. They did not have adequate hydration. And this person's death became an exemplar of how climate change is impacting that community by having to work longer hours in high heat, in these oppressive conditions, which are only going to get worse as the climate continues to worsen. It's stories like that give me hope that that folks who don't think that this is their issue or who don't think that there's an impact for them, they start to see it. And we just need to make sure that everyone sees themselves reflected in this struggle and that they are supported in this struggle.
Great. Well, I want to make sure and have some time to get to some questions from the audience. So we'll just jump in here. Since climate change is impacting people of color the most, how can we get more people of color involved in joining the fight and remove the negative stigma? That's from Sadat.
Since I kind of just partially addressed that, my response is what we have to do, and this has come up here on the panel, is listen to folks. The climate impacts are real, but it may not be expressed in the same way that we're used to hearing. Somebody might talk about the fact that a farm worker is working longer hours because the growing seasons have changed. The amount of time that they have to pick these crops is now condensed because of these shifting growing cycles, which means they're working longer hours and in worse conditions. Those people are being impacted by climate change. Let's support their stories, let's support their work. And there are examples like this across every industry, across every sector, across every population and constituency, and we just have to recognize those as climate stories and support and promote them as such. We also, people need to see themselves reflected in the work that's happening, and that's also, we need to spend some more time and attention in making sure that people who, once again, have not been part of the conversation are supported to be a part of the conversation.
And I'll add to that, education's important. So there's been work at the university working with some of the farm workers in the eastern part of the state on heat stress. Heat stress is a real issue that's going to become much more urgent as the climate changes. And not understanding the connection between climate change and increasing heat stress, so that educational component is really important. And also even thinking in our own community in South Seattle, that people are poor and marginalized for reasons, and they live in areas that are most vulnerable to climate change. And they understand their vulnerability, they don't always understand the connection with a changing climate. And so helping make those conversations happen so that they can make the connections then really can lead to very different kinds of outcomes, different kinds of advocacy, and new voices.
Okay, this one is from Kia. In your expert view, do you see a sustainable future under capitalism? It's a big one. But maybe it's an opportunity to talk about it. Yeah. Solve everything right now.
It's a great question, because one of the underlying of capitalism is consumption. And can you do that? I think sometimes you can turn this around a bit, and we can use capitalism, carbon tax, for example, or a fee and dividend approach. So while that's market generated, and so I think there are elements to doing that can succeed. And I think you can look at just the wind farms and the economics of renewable energy. But I also think that we do need incentives. We do need other things that help us transition to this area that we need to go to. And I think some of that does require, maybe I'm just a regulation guy, but some of that does require requirements and mandatory. If we really want to get there in this 10 or 15 or 20 or 30 years, I'm not sure, to be perfectly honest, if we can get there just based on a carbon tax or try to let the market work its way through. I'm not sure if we can do that, personally.
I grew up in the auto industry, and my electric vehicle really doesn't look that much different than a Model T Ford. It looks, frankly, remarkably the same. There's so much that we can do, and we need to make sure we partner with business. That's where much of our innovation comes from. We need to think about new manufacturing. We need to think about new ways of providing the services that we've grown accustomed to in ways that support sustainability for the planet. And when you look at industry, so many of them are committed strongly to this issue and are really trying to work to make change. They can be very effective partners in really moving forward on these solutions. And they're advocating at all scales. I do a lot of work internationally, and you see them at the international fora. They want to make sure that the shifts that need to take place, that they can be effective parties to, and that they can make sure that, in fact, we do move to a sustainable future where we can have lives that look relatively similar to today, but resilient to a changing climate.
If I could just address super quickly, I would say that capital markets, so we can address multiple things. There is inequality that is exacerbated by capitalism. Capitalism also provides some of the resources needed to develop these technological innovations. Solar panels would not be as low cost and ubiquitous as they are now without functioning markets. Same with any new technology. That doesn't mean that markets are good necessarily. It doesn't mean that markets are bad. It just means that we need to design our economic system and any approach that we have to deal with climate change in a way that tries to minimize inequities and maximize the positive benefits.
Can I just say one? I know a couple years ago EPA gives out, I'll talk really fast, sustainability awards for businesses. Everything, when they got up there and talked, they said three things why we're doing this. One, it makes economic sense. Two, our customers want it. And three, our employees demand it. And so when I heard that, I was going, wow. And these were some big companies that were saying, we are going on that direction. So kind of going what you're saying, I think there is, but again, it's up to us. We're the demand. We got to make that happen. And so just to say, businesses go do good, they got to hear from us. We got to change our habits.
Okay, I think we have time for maybe one more. This one is from Anonymous. What is the role of humor in addressing the environmental catastrophes we are facing?
It's an important one, I would argue. I like to laugh at myself. I don't get it right all the time. There are some great examples. I think maybe in addition to humor, music and rap and creativity and art, are all really important forms, and there's actually a session here today after lunch about the intersection of climate change and art, and I would put sort of humor and dialogue in that space. And so I think when it comes to connecting people to this issue and bringing more voices in the conversation, I really think it's about owning your own voice and knowing that you are your greatest own asset for climate action. And however you do that, through creativity, through thinking academically, there's so many ways that we need to evolve this conversation and that action will emerge. And so I think using our greatest strengths and interests and where we're creative and innovative is really the way that we're going to create the society and community we want in light of a changing climate.
And I'll celebrate some of the big comedians that we have on television. Almost all of them have done wonderful segments on climate change. I think Stephen Colbert has got this wonderful segment where he says, I don't believe in yogurt. I've seen the cups, but I don't believe there's anything in there. There's there's wonderful things that you can do with humor and with art. So I think all has to be part of the conversation.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much. That's about all the time we have for, but also probably the best place we could hope to end it. So thank you so much to our panelists, to the audience.
Believe in yogurt.
Thanks for listening to Crosscut Talks. This week's episode was recorded by Victoria Ralph and produced by Sarah Bernard. Audio from the Crosscut Festival was recorded by Seattle Theater Group. You can subscribe to Crosscut Talks on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. For more on the Crosscut Talks podcast, go to crosscut.com/talks. And for the latest political, environmental, and culture news from the Pacific Northwest, visit crosscut.com. And just a reminder to save the date for the next Crosscut Festival, May 1st and 2nd, 2020. To learn more, go to crosscut.com/festival. Crosscut Talks is a product of Cascade Public Media. I'm Mark Bumgarten. We'll be back next week with another episode.